You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Annie Harview. Tonight, we are dedicating the entire hour to one of our local publishers, Queen of Swords Press, and three of its authors who are with us tonight in studio. One of those authors is the publisher of Queen of Swords, Catherine Lundoff, who will not only discuss her writing, but also talk shop about the publishing business and her experience with Queen of Swords. Catherine is joined by novelist Jennifer Goloboy and short story writer Michael Merriam. We will learn more about them and their work in a moment. All of this and stay more, so stay tuned to Write On Radio.
Welcome back to Right On Radio. I am Dave Fettig. I will be joined by Savvy Molesky. Hi, Savvy.
Hello.
We're very excited. We have a special show tonight, as you just heard. 1 hour with Queen of Swords Press and their writers, some of their writers. So we're going to start at the top with Jennifer Goloboy, and then we're going to talk to Michael, and then Catherine, and a lot of other things in between. So, Jennifer.
Hey,
welcome.
I'm awfully glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me here.
It's exciting. Obviously, Aliens is the novel. So before we talk about that, tell us a little bit about you and your background as a writer and how you came to sci-fi, please.
So I have kind of an unusual background. I've been trying to write sci-fi for a very long time, got serious about 10 years ago. I also work as a literary agent. I represent science fiction and fantasy and have some really fantastic authors.
So pay attention, listeners. We have an agent in the house. Woot! Okay. Obviously, Aliens, clearly a sci-fi novel by the title. It gives itself away. I want to begin at the beginning here with a question for you. Something happens with a soda can, which is kind of out there, but that's sci-fi. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that, because that kicks the story off. And give us a sense of the story so people have a sense for what the story's about. But I want you to focus on this soda can at the beginning.
Sure. So we start the book with a woman named Dana Alson. And all she wants to do is, she's a commercial artist. She's come up with a design for the Doges of the Month Club. She's trying to sell to a major manufacturer. She's waiting at the airport. She's getting ready to give her pitch. She's all psyched up. She's planning what it's going to be like when she goes to the meeting the next day and knocks him dead. And she drinks from the wrong soda bottle, and she accidentally becomes the host of a dead person.
Yeah, so, yeah, she swallows the host of a dead person. Anyway, how did you come up with that idea? Let's start with that.
You know, I never question where my ideas come from.
Yeah.
I just kind of run with them. I think one of the things I wanted to write a road trip novel, and I wanted to write sort of an opposites attract road trip novel where two people who had no reason to be in the car together were forced to travel together and work together and find common cause. And so what happens, Dana accidentally becomes the host of Jay, who's Adam's boyfriend, and there's all she wants to do is sell these figurines, get back to where she was supposed to be in life, so she and Adam have to work together. And it gets really complicated really fast.
Yes, it does. in a good way.
Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit more about Dana. She's a very appealing character. I ask you these, where did they come from stories? But and a broader question wrapped into that is, this is really, for me, a story about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
With sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that as a very high compliment. Tell us about where these characters came from, these amazing young people.
You know, she, I try to think about, so one of the things I've been told as a writer is there are certain things that you naturally come more easily to you, and you can just kind of run with them. My characters always just sort of show up, and it's mm-hmm. about planing off the edges that don't quite make sense and refining things rather than consciously. I have friends who do all kinds of methods to sort of summon forth their characters. I've known people to do things like, oh, what's their sign? Almost like a D&D character. Mine just show up. And they want things. And if you could say, where did Dana come from? It was always a matter of just having this really, the person who just wants her life to go back to normal again.
Yeah.
And try to find her a goal that was sort of relatable, maybe a little ridiculous, because she's really, really, really serious about these little dog figurines that she wants to sell. But relatable and never odd. And so that's where she came from, really.
Yeah. It's a peculiar world you've created, in the sense that, at least as I read it, where people just sort of take the presence of aliens and strange means of transportation and just as a matter of course, they don't seem too startled by it. Things has happened. A lot of things happen. Aliens come down and land in Iowa, and well, you know, I guess. Makes good use of Iowa. I mean, is this intentional? I mean, is this sort of tone of it's light, it's fun, mm-hmm. but still serious?
Mm-hmm. I would say that the thing that really motivates it is what I really like doing is taking a situation that normally would be a tragedy or a disaster movie, and can you make a comedy out of this thing?
Yeah.
Can you, oh no, aliens are headed towards Earth. I mean, how many scary movies have there been about aliens headed towards Earth? What if aliens showed up and it was basically okay?
Right.
I think the fun thing about writing comedy is that you can sort of take it as the insistence this is not going to be a tragic story, that mm-hmm. this is going to be that, you know, things might happen and we're just going to deal with it and it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And I started writing this. I started seriously writing this in 2017, and okay. It was a rough year, and I liked the idea of writing a story where everything was going to basically be okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I thank you for that. It was a really neat experience. I've lost my train of thought now, so I'm going to go to...
No.
That's a quote from one page, on page 122, which you don't have your book memorized, I'm sure, but it's a Jonathan Franzen reference, and I have to ask you, what the heck's going on there, Jennifer? All right.
Sorry, I just had to make that.
I'm going to read it for the folks here. So this is Dana we're referring to here, I believe. Dana just gotten to the worst sex scene she'd ever read that wasn't by Jonathan Franzen when the door opened. Now, I've read Jonathan Franzen. Freedom, I believe, is the name of the book. The one with the bird on the cover? It's quite good. I was impressed. So tell us what's going on here. I got to go back and open that book again. But what's up with Jonathan Franzen?
I was shocked Catherine let me keep that joke in there. There are certain jokes.
Is he that bad?
I really hated the corrections.
Okay,
and part of it was, it's so huge. You know, you get this thing and it's like, I'm going to consume some literature. And then it's just the La Brea tar pit of literature. You're in and you're never getting out again. And he could take it. I am convinced if he ever read this, he could take it.
He'd laugh out. Yeah, he laughed. That was nice. I appreciate that. So, and that's a word up to the listeners that there's a lot of fun writing in this book and you'll enjoy it. So I am not a science fiction maven, and mm-hmm. I enjoyed this, and I'm trying to explore the genre even more, but I understand it to be the case that often science fiction writers use their worlds as a proxy for the real world, if mm-hmm. you will, to tell us, make us think about something mm-hmm. going on in our own lives. So is that true of this book? And if so, what were you after?
Oh, that's a good question. Thank you. You know, part of it, I can say this on KFAI, I was very unhappy with the Trump presidency.
Ah, yes. You're among friends.
One of the reasons I was very unhappy with the Trump presidency is the treatment of immigration. And I thought, you know, There is something troubling about the idea that every time we have an alien invasion story, mm-hmm. they're scary aliens. They're mm-hmm. they're not, you know, yeah. just people like us trying to figure out how they're going to live their lives. So there was this political edge to it, honestly, but I also wanted to rise and fall as a story between people who maybe didn't have a lot of in common, having to work together, having to find a way to understand each other.
Well, you did that beautifully, because the danger of trying to do something like that, of course, mm-hmm. the work can become very didactic, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And not so much fun then.
Mm-hmm.
But you pulled that off.
Thank you.
Did you start with that idea, or did it come to you?
I am one of those writers, and you'll have to ask the other two if they're the same way, who always has to sort of back in slowly into the thesis.
Okay.
It always starts with the people, putting them in a situation that's tricky for them, getting them in and out of trouble. And then you stand back and you think, oh, that's what was really going on here yeah. the whole time.
Great. We're going to segue soon to Michael, believe it or not. Time flies on these shows. We have our own science fiction world in here. And anyway, I had that. Nice try, Dave. So here, I have a question for all three of you. We'll treat it as a panel question, okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask for help from Savvy to make this question make sense, which is science fiction writers create a world, right, from whole cloth. And that's got to be difficult. You want to help me out here, Savvy?
I'm really interested in how you put the world together, where you get inspired to create things that don't necessarily exist in our world, how you find consistency in the things that you put in your world, and basically how it just kind of all comes together when none of it really exists in real life.
Yeah, I love that question. So we're going to go in order, Jennifer, and then Michael, and then Catherine. Same question. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Well, I will say that one of the fun things about this book is researching stories about aliens.
Oh,
and
yes.
There were some, there is a secret government committee that meets under Denver Airport, and there was a reason for that. And there are stories over the years of something really weird going on at Denver Airport. I am only sad there are certain things I couldn't get in there. Like, there's a terrifying horse
yes.
outside Denver Airport. It's bright blue and has glowing
yes.
red eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And if there had only been some way I could get that into the book, it just didn't work. It was sad. I did try to get some real world things and just make them funny. We go to MIA, the Art Institute, and there's I ruined a statue there, which, as far as I know, is still there and still just fine. But it always looked kind of unstable to me. So yeah, for me in this particular book, it was more about taking the real world and heightening it a bit, and maybe blowing up some stories that I'd heard and playing with them.
Nice.
Definitely.
Michael?
So I fully admit that a lot of times I cheat. I write a lot of what's called urban fantasy, and so I use a real-world setting, and I just kind of do adjacent stuff to it. You know, mm-hmm. I just add a fantastical element. So I do that mostly, you know, with urban fantasy. I write a lot of steampunk where, again, I'm using kind of a more or less real-world setting, but I'm adding a fantastical technology element, maybe fantastical creatures. with what we're going to talk about later and read from today, right. that was a little more whole cloth, because that was a little more space opera, a little more science fiction. So I really had to decide what I wanted that universe to look like and what I wanted the people in it to look like.
Right.
And
and
so it was just a fair amount of just thinking, just sitting around and thinking and going, so if then this, and if I did this, then this. And,
right. Great. Catherine.
Well, I write in a bunch of different genres, and so there's a lot of crossover into things. So some of my work is much further out from reality than others. In the case of the menopausal werewolf books, which is
yes.
Silver Moon and Blood Moon and eventually Blue Moon, which I'm working on now, which will be the third one, I started with a jumping off point on one of those medical sites that was talking about the symptoms of menopause. And I wanted to write about older women as protagonists within science fiction, fantasy, and horror. Mm-hmm. And because there were not a ton at the time when the original edition of Silver Moon came out in 2012, and I reissued it with Queen of Swords, so it came out in 2017, and this is, you know, Blood Moon is out now as of last year. And I wanted to kind of play with that idea. So I was looking at this medical site, and it was, you know, symptoms, you know, unexplained hair growth, mood swings, longer teeth as your gums recede, you know. And I was like, you know what that sounds like?
Oh, that's great.
And we went from there. So it's still very much set in, you know, it's set in a small town in the West. Think, you know, New Mexico-Colorado border a few years ago. It's dealing with people who have, you know, real world problems. One of the werewolves is a recovering alcoholic, for example. So they're dealing with a lot of, you know, real world issues. They're just werewolves.
Right.
So they, you know, there's the things that they're dealing with on a supernatural plane, as well as the things that they're dealing with in their mundane lives. So.
Absolutely.
Jenny, I was so excited to get this conversation going. I forgot to ask you to do your reading for us. Do you have something?
I do.
Please.
All right. Well, this is pretty far into the book. This is Dana at the desert home. She and one of her siblings, who's named Sierra, are staying at the moment. They have inherited from their father. The other character we're going to see is Sadie, who's a spy who happens to look exactly like a corgi.
Awesome.
Dana woke up at 6 the next morning to barking outside her window. Vigorous barking, not a coyote or a wolf, the sort of noise that would come from a small dog, say a corgi-sized dog. "Sadie," she whispered out the window. "Yes," Sadie said. "I need to speak with you. It's urgent." "Oomph," said Dana, and rolled over, pulling the stale, saggy pillow over her head. Could she sleep through Sadie's barking? She wasn't sure, but she was tired enough to try. "Dana," said Sadie. "Dana." She waited a moment and then started to bark again. She was amazingly loud for such a small animal. Dana heard the front door open and then Sierra's voice. "Look at you! Hello, you sweet girl! Are you lost?" There was a tiny bark as Sadie obviously got caught. "I've got you," said Sierra. "Let's take you inside. How about some water? Hey, good girl. And I might even have a nice can of dog food for you." Dana considered staying in bed and letting Sierra deal with Spy Dog. If Sadie arrived alone, the odds she was planning to arrest Dana were pretty small. So there must be something else Sadie wanted. As far as Dana was concerned, Sadie had blown her off when she needed help, and she was perfectly all right about returning the favor. But then again, what would Sadie do to Sierra? Grumbling and yanking down her brother Ace's ZZ Top t-shirt over her sister Mina's University of Arizona sweatpants, Dana trudged angrily to the kitchen. Sadie was slurping water out of the dish but raised her lip when Sierra offered her a can of Alpo. "I don't recognize this dog," said Sierra, "and she's obviously someone's pet. Her fur looks really soft and fluffy." Sadie preened. "Do you think one of our family left her behind?" continued Sierra. "No," said Dana. "I'm pretty sure she's my neighbor's dog." "Back in Albuquerque? So how'd she get out here?" Sierra bent down and scratched Sadie behind the ears. Despite herself, Sadie looked pleased. "I wish she could tell us." Yes, that would be interesting, thought Dana. But then Dana realized she could hear something, a sort of high-pitched whistling noise. Sadie whimpered and ducked under the kitchen table. Dana followed her, and so did Sierra. What is that? Said Dana. I don't know, said Sierra, but I've heard that dogs can detect all kinds of... Suddenly, there was a gigantic crash outside. Barking excitedly, Sadie ran towards the front door. She scratched the door with her paws, leaving marks on the wood. Dana opened the door, and Sadie bolted out, followed by Dana and Sierra. Stopping only to pull on the sneakers she left by the front door, Dana chased Sadie across the sand, Sierra pounding behind. The three followed a long, burned streak across the desert. Sadie stopped suddenly, and Dana did the same, catching her breath as she realized they'd come to a halt near the edge of a charred-looking crater. Half buried at the bottom of the crater was a small, silver, egg-shaped craft. It looked like an escape pod from a spaceship, Dana thought, as Sierra caught up to her and Sadie. This isn't safe, said Dana. Maybe we should get back to that house. The dog's not afraid, said Sierra. Animals are very wise about this kind of thing. What do dogs know about alien spaceships? Asked Dana. And I think I'll stop there.
Thank you, Jenny. That was Jenny Goloboy reading from Obviously Aliens, a book out from Queen of Swords Press, our very own Queen of Swords Press. And the corgi is on the cover, ladies and gentlemen. You want the book for the really cute
check
cover.
Out the spine.
Yes. Yeah, yes, yes, yes. It's all wonderful. Okay, we're going to turn now to Michael Merriam. Michael, to begin, just give us a little bit about your writing history, and then we're going to start talking about your short story, Tanari.
Sure. I've been doing this off and on for an awfully, awfully long time, I realized recently. I actually came up originally through, like, lit poetry and lit fic back in the 80s, and then I stopped writing, and then I came back into science fiction about 20 years ago or so.
Okay.
That's what I read primarily, so that ended up being, you know, what I was going to write primarily. So
awesome.
That's been basically how I got
here. We're going to get to your reading on this, but since we just had a reading, we'll buffer it with a little bit of conversation first, and I'm going to turn it over to Savvy for a question.
You mentioned reading mainly sci-fi, so since this is one of you, sounds like you don't write a whole lot of sci-fi, from what you said earlier, that this was kind of like a newer idea for you. Do you have any specific sci-fi classics that really inspired you to give it a shot of your own, or what inspired you to take on sci-fi?
You know, for the space opera science fiction stuff, as opposed to the urban fantasy and whatnot, I got into it because I always like the more fantastical science fiction, the really what we call space opera, like Star Wars space opera or science fantasy, as it were. And so that I've always kind of enjoyed. I'm trying to, you asked me for specific authors, and now I'm like, I don't know. I read books with and there was words in them, right? And words are hard, and there were books. I mean, I'm old enough that I grew up with all the Golden Age science fiction. So, so your Asimovs, your Heinleins, your Clarks, your and then later on the New Wave guys, your Zelaznys and what's his name, the little short guy that mean to Harlan Ellison. Harlan's dead. He can't punch me now.
Yeah. I was going to say, just call
Jonathan Franzen's not dead. I'm just going to say.
Yeah, Franzen's still alive.
So you mentioned space opera. Tell us about Tanari, because it has that feel. And not only about this story, but it feels like it's a part of something bigger, maybe?
Yeah, it is. There was a moment when I was writing, for whatever reason, a lot of space opera. And so I was kind of building this space opera universe, which I have not gone back to now in quite a while.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I've been thinking about it. Catherine and I have talked a little bit about it. And I'm still kind of like backburnering it. I've got some other projects ahead of it. This story really started with the opening line. And I don't even remember how I ended up with the opening line, but I had set out to write a space opera pirate story, like purposely. That's what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, but what's my angle? What's my angle? What's my angle? And then I just got that opening line that, you know, we'll read and we'll get. And I'm like,
yeah, it's good.
Oh yeah, that's my angle. And so it was more about, these are not your super bloodthirsty pirates. They're not a bad bunch of people. They're just kind of caught by circumstance, and so that's why they do what they do.
It's a great first line, Michael. It tells us a lot about the story and the character especially. Mm. Yeah, it's really nice. Boy, we've talked about it. Savvy, you have another question?
Not lined up at the moment.
Okay, well,
if we want to buffer before the reading,
yes.
It seems like it would be a good time to jump into the reading, mentioning the opening line and everything.
A great segue for a reading.
Yeah.
Michael.
Sure. I can get the light here. So I walked out of my house and forgot my reading glasses. And,
oh, no.
And as y'all might not have guessed, I'm actually legally blind. So, there's going to be extra light, though.
Well, the light switch is. So we'll keep talking while this happens.
We're just looking for a light.
There we are. Oh. We're getting some extra light.
There we go. Oh, here wow. We go. Thank you so very much.
Yep.
The thing that surprised Captain Kathleen Reed the most about commanding a pirate ship was the amount of paperwork it involved. She set her data pad on the gray metal desk and closed her eyes. Pain was starting to set in behind and between her eyes, the kind of pain that only the master of a marauding space vessel knew. Too much paperwork, not enough plunder. That was the problem. If only she'd stayed sober, she would have never gotten into this mess. The ship's intercom buzzed on her desk. She barely recognized the voice over the static. She thought it might be her executive officer, and he might have said captain to the bridge, which was reason enough for her to leave the ship's accounts unfinished. Captain Reed stepped from her ready room to the bridge of her ship, the Black Manta. She looked at her executive officer, Roger Baldry. He was well into his 70s. Most thought him too old for this life, and he did have grandchildren back on Pegasus. But she knew Roger Baldry could outfight, outthink, and outdrink any two of her crew. "What have we got?" she asked. "Civilian bulk freighter," Baldry said. "An old Savros, probably a second series Model 3. She raised an eyebrow. "All the way out here and alone?" A throat cleared. Captain Reed turned to her chief of gunnery and ex-wife. "Yes, Janet?" "It's a trap, Captain. That's a Melpomene cruiser disguised as a freighter. There's no other explanation." Reed nodded. Janet Sobrinsky thought everything was a trap, up to and including the food served in the mess. The annoying thing was, sometimes Janet was right. "Orders, Captain?" Baldry asked. Reed looked out her window at the freighter. "Fire a laser burst and transmit an order to cut their engines and prepare to be boarded. Tell them if they cooperate, no one gets hurt." "Aye, ma'am," Janet said. Reed felt the low hum of her ship's cannon powering up. The lights on the bridge dimmed, and the ship gave a slight shudder as the weapon discharged. The engines on the big freighter glowed white-blue, and the ship turned starboard and down. "They're running," Baldry said. "So it seems," Reed sighed. "Match their speed and course. Stay with them, helm." "Aye, ma'am," her helmsman said. "They won't get away." Captain Reed was not worried about her quarry escaping. Old her ship might be, but there was no way a freighter would be able to best the Black Manta's speed and maneuverability. "Exo, get the boarding party together and down at the airlock. I'll join you after we dock. And Roger, tell everyone we're going to be extra careful over there. They might be smugglers this far from the normal shipping lanes." Baldry nodded. "Yes, ma'am," he said. Reed turned to her gunner. "Target their engines. Use a missile. I want them to know we mean business." There was a metallic clank from deep in the ship, and the Black Manta rocked. "Missile away," Janet reported. Reed watched the chemically propelled weapon close rapidly on the target. She was surprised at the lack of any countermeasures by the freighter. The warhead on the missile exploded before impact, sending a shockwave in the back of the ship. The old freighter's engines dimmed. "Helm, take us in."
Thank you, Michael. That was Michael Merriam reading from Tenaria, short story. Wonderful. So how can people get a hold of this story?
It is in the Queen of Swords Press anthology.
Scourge of the Seas
of Time and Space.
Yes.
Scourge of the Seas of Time and Space.
There it is, folks. You heard it live on KFAI Radio, right on radio. And listeners are used to at this time hearing the Rain Taxi calendar of book events, whatever we call that. So let's do that, Annie. How would you like to proceed, guys? Hey, And we are back with Jenny Golovoy, Michael Merriam, and Catherine Lundoff, writers from Queen of Swords Press. I'm going to turn things over to Savvy now to talk to Catherine about her book.
Thank you so much, David. All right, Catherine, so great to have you here. I will have the pleasure of reading your newest publication called Blood Moon. It is the second in the Wolves of Wolf Point novels. Do you want to go ahead and give us a little bit of a rundown on it?
Sure. So Wolves of Wolf's Point is my menopausal werewolf series, and it's Silver Moon starts out with a woman named Becca Thornton, who discovers that shortly after her 50th birthday, she turns into a werewolf. And she then goes on to discover that a number of the other women in town of a certain age are part of the local werewolf pack. And I'm using a lot of things like place-based magic, so they're protective rather than necessarily going out and, you know, just sort of running amok on the full moon and, you know, a Lon Chaney or something. You know, but it's not that they absolutely don't do that. They just, you know, they're limited in place to where they roam and to the role that they're supposed to be playing, which is the protection of their community. And so the first book is about Becca sort of finding her new self and developing a big crush on her next door neighbor, who is also a werewolf. And so it's about found family and coming out at midlife and being a menopausal werewolf and the things that go with that. And book two picks up where book one leaves off. So I do recommend reading them in order if that's a possibility. And it has more murder mystery elements to it. It has more supernatural elements to it. And it builds on a lot of the ground that I laid in the first book. And there will be a third book working on it.
So in the foreword for the book, you go into detail a little bit about there being a lapse in between, mm-hmm. being able to put out the first and the second book. And it became really obvious to me that you are very connected to your characters in this book, and it seems like you are also a part of this wolf pack in my own, like in the way I read it. So how long have they been with you? Do you feel like you have kind of always been a part of this wolf pack in some way, shape, or form, or is it something that just kind of came to you as you wrote the book?
I started working on it in the original, the first book. There was a novella before there was a novel, and I started working on that in, I think, 2010. So I've been kind of playing around with it for a while, and I, you know, wrote the first book. It came out into the world, and people's immediate reaction was, "Where is book two?" Mm-hmm. I'm like, in the back of my brain. So a lot of life happened before I got a chance to re-release book one and then, you know, really dig into book two. I parted ways with my previous publisher. Wacky hijinks ensued, and there was a great deal of life, very much life. I've been kind of, you know, working on Blood Moon sporadically for a couple of years. In the intervening times between 2017 and 2021, I started a publishing company, put out another novel, put out several collections of short stories, and published a bunch of other people's books. So, in my defense,
been busy.
There were things.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and give the listeners a little bit of taste of Blood Moon, shall we?
Okay.
Go ahead and do a reading.
Sounds good. All right, I'm going to read a little bit of the first half of chapter one. Erin Adams looked out at the mountains and tried not to think about what was in the trunk of her car. At least the mountains around Wolf's Point were still as beautiful as ever. She wondered if she'd get the chance to run through them again, feel the wind in her fur, the ground flying by under her paws, the pack at her side. That thought was enough to make her look back at her car. Erin rubbed her aching forehead with one hand and closed her eyes. This was, without question, the worst thing she'd ever done, even if she couldn't remember doing it. But maybe there was still time to call Shelley and get her help to figure a way out of this mess that she'd blundered into. That was what pack alphas did, or so Shelley kept reminding her. But that might make Shelley an accessory if they got caught, or rather, when she got caught. Erin closed her eyes for an instant. Lying was never a thing she'd been good at or wanted to get good at. Anyone she called would almost certainly go down with her. That thought hit her like a truck. The pack couldn't afford to be without its alpha so soon after they got her back, not to mention what it would do to Pia and the kids. There was no way she could drag Shelley into this. Her thoughts turned to Becca, waded through a jumbled mess of emotions, and came back with a single realization. They'd suspect her first. Becca was her friend, her housemate, her something they still hadn't defined, but which felt more like girlfriend every day. Her stomach did a slow, leisurely flip when she thought about that, and she almost smiled. But this wasn't the time to think about Becca. She couldn't afford to be distracted, to be vulnerable. Not now. Maybe there was another solution, a way to hide what had happened. But then what? She'd still know, and she'd have to carry the burden of what she'd done alone. And she knew where that road led. Falling off the wagon to cope with her guilt wasn't an option either. Besides, if she ditched the body out here and it was found, the regular wolves would certainly get blamed for it. The new governor was already pushing for a wolf hunting season, and that would put things right over the edge. She didn't want that on her conscience either. The wild wolves were kin as much as they were cover for the pack. Erin ran her fingers through her short-cropped brown hair, wondering if there was anyone else she could turn to. But she couldn't think of any other pack member who'd be able to do anything about this situation. No more than she could do herself, anyway. Certainly wasn't the sort of thing that her AA sponsor had signed up for, or any of her friends, for that matter. So she was on her own. There was nothing for it but to lie in the bed she'd made for herself. She pulled her cell phone out of her pocket and selected a contact. Hi, it's Erin. I've done something I need. Can you come up to Spruce Point? Yes, it's important. I want you to see it before Sheriff Henderson does. She clicked the phone off and glanced toward the road. Nothing to do now but wait. And I'll stop there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Let's see. Earlier, you talked a little bit about pulling from the real world and just kind of adding extraordinary elements to it, as far as like place magic, werewolves, obviously. Do you find it challenging to sort of balance human traits with extraordinary characteristics? Like, where do you find that those two things merge?
Well,
I think you did a really wonderful job with it. There was a moment where one of the characters was thinking about the time, and there's a paragraph talking about how she was relying on a clock as opposed to her internal clock of knowing when the moon was going to rise and reverting back to her human habits of continuously checking the clock. And so, I don't know, you just brought a lot of humanness to the characters. So I want to know where the balance was for you.
I mean, I think of it kind of holistically. I mean, I think that, you know, in part because of how this particular pack of werewolves is created, I think of them as being closer to human than as monsters.
Definitely.
And so that's definitely part of the, you know, the group that I created and how I view them, you know, behaving within that context. Because, you know, it's you don't really want to take a, you know, group of middle-aged ladies and suddenly go, and then they go nuts and run amok and eat everybody, and, you know, ripping faces off right and left. You know, it's not the book that a lot of readers have signed on for.
Next, I kind of want to get into the main characters being middle-aged women, senior women, and also coming out as queer and coming out later in life. Just a lot of changes for these women at a point where most of society just kind of puts them in the corner, you know, and doesn't shine the light on them as main characters. And what does it mean to you to bring that representation in your stories?
Oh, it's pretty huge. So in 2012, when the first book came out, Silver Moon came out, I started a bibliography of... And I set the bar kind of low. It was female protagonists 40 and over in science fiction and fantasy and horror who were heroes of their own lives. Wow. That was like the baseline.
One hand? You could name them all on one hand.
We got to 20. And, you know, and it was really interesting what happened after that because it started really picking up. And there were more and more books and stories. And in some cases, they were things that were getting rediscovered. And in other cases, they were new. And... you know, I do a lot of panels on aging and representation in the genre. And one of the things that we started seeing more and more of was that as some of the writers in the field who are more established got older, they started writing older characters, which mm-hmm. is something they hadn't been doing before. And so there's a lot more stuff. So a nice fan spun up a Goodreads list. So now there's like a couple of hundred things out there, and there's a few more added, you know, every month. And so it's been expanding pretty quickly, which has been really nice to see. Still a small subset in the genre, and some people don't know what a protagonist is, but that's another story.
Oh, dear. So I was so jazzed to learn about Queen of Swords Press and that just that it existed. It seems to be very heavily represent underrepresented demographics, queer people, older people, minorities, the like. Do you think the lack of inclusion is something that inspired you to start your own publishing press? To get more of a wave in there and everything?
In a manner of speaking, yes. So representation by queer authors tends to kind of come and go in the field. Mm-hmm. So you get sort of waves of things, but it will only be short fiction and it will only be a certain kind of thing, sort of like just be a subset of YA and yep. then nothing. And or it'll just be mainstream science fiction and just science fiction, not fantasy, and then nothing. You know, so that there's a lot of... I've been in the field, you know, both as a fan and as a writer before I became a publisher for a long time. So I've been around just long enough to watch this kind of, you know, hey, we have a fad. So I started Queen of Swords Press for a variety of reasons. One, it was something I'd been wanting to try. I used to be a bookseller back in the day before I was a writer. Mm-hmm. I'd spent years as a writer. I've edited. And it was kind of the next logical thing to tackle. So I wanted to try that. And I wasn't entirely sure what kind. I mean, I had a vision for how this was going to work. There was a business plan. I spent a couple of years prepping for it. I started the press in 2017. We just celebrated our fifth birthday.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And, you know, I started out with a specific kind of vision of the sort of work that I expected to be publishing. And then submissions started showing up. So our first couple of authors, I started with my own backlist. So the first year was my backlist. And then after that, we started, you know, bringing in more authors. There became a we. I have a part-time assistant. I have, you know, a book designer who works in White Bear Lake, who, you know, makes all of our books really pretty. You know, cover artists. I have interns. So we've really been kind of growing. We are about to release our 14th title, which I'm really excited about. That'll come out next month. And that's a retelling of Beauty and the Beast called Language of Roses by an author named Heather Rose Jones, who's out on the West Coast. But one of the things that I wanted to do was, well, I started out with Alex Axe was our first other author. Our first not me author. And Alex is a trans author from Colorado who does just some amazing work with steampunk adventures. They're very class conscious. They're, you know, the creation of the world is very intense and very exciting. So they're a lot of fun. So we released a couple of those. I did the anthology that Michael mentioned, Scourge of the Seas of Time and Space, where we ended up with authors from 12 different countries.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And exotic Hopkins. And one of the authors who came in with a story for that was an author from New Zealand, AJ Fitzwater. And I knew AJ socially from, you know, previous things. And we traveled to New Zealand for a convention a few years ago. And I fell madly in love with AJ's character, who is a dapper lesbian capybara pirate. And AJ is also a trans author, you know, and is, you know, somebody who's done, you know, they went to Clarion. They do a lot of literary workshops mm-hmm. in the context of New Zealand. They do, you know, a lot of their literary festivals. And so I approached AJ and asked them to pull together a collection of stories about this character. So that was our pandemic book. So that came out in April of 2020. And then stuff happened. The really good news about that one, though, was it was after we had to cancel and rearrange everything and scramble to get everything online and all the stuff we went through. The Voyages of Sinrak the Dapper won a Sir Julius Vogel Award for Best Collection last year.
Oh, wow.
And that's like New Zealand's Hugo Awards. They're the national awards for the best science fiction out in a given year. So,
and that's amazing.
So, go AJ. And then after that, I ended up getting introduced via AJ and my webmaster, who's also in New Zealand, to another trans New Zealand author named Rem Wigmore. And Reb sent in this amazing solar punk novel called Fox Hunt. And Fox Hunt is set in the distant future of Earth. You know, humans have just barely survived the ecological apocalypse, and it's about rebuilding and the things that go wrong when you rebuild and you don't think some stuff through. And it's a great novel. Tor.com has called it one of the five essential solar punk books you should be reading. Got a glowing review in the in Publishers Weekly, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
So really excited about that. We're going to put out the sequel to that one in December. Then along the way, I'd opened up for submissions, and Jenny, who is not trans and not from New Zealand.
Not even from Hopkins.
sent me this terrific story, which is how we got to obviously aliens. And one of the things I'd been wanting to do was that I wanted to publish a wide range of authors from different backgrounds.
Definitely.
So I, you know, wasn't setting out specifically to only publish LGBTQ plus authors. I also wanted to include, you know, other authors. I'd like to keep, you know, building on the success we've gotten so far. So Jenny sent in this great novel. So we put that out in last year. It came out in November. And yeah. And then the next thing that's coming up, and this, we just signed the contract a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
Michael Merriam. We're going to be re-releasing Michael Merriam's really great urban fantasy, which is set in Minneapolis.
Nice.
It's set in Minneapolis in the 2000s. Among other things, it features the ghost of the streetcar line.
Oh.
And we're going to put that out this summer.
Yep.
In its previous incarnation, it was only released in ebook. It's never had a print edition before. So we're going to have a print edition, and we'll have an ebook edition and all that good stuff. And
Tell us the name.
It's called Last Car to Anwen Station.
Last Car to
Anwen Station.
Anwen Station by Michael Merriam, coming up this summer. Wonderful.
Yep.
Sounds like you got a lot in the works for this coming year.
Yeah. Piling it all on.
We've heard a lot of terms, if I may jump in here, steampunk and so on. You said solar punk.
Yeah, that's one also unfamiliar with.
You have to tell us about what in the world.
Solar punk is comparatively new. It's a science fiction and science fiction mostly subgenre that posits a more positive future. So, you know, humans have, for whatever reason, either because they haven't barely survived the ecological apocalypse, or because they took a different path and averted it completely, to have turned to clean energy. So a lot of things in the books are literally solar powered. So that's part of where it comes from. It's also called climate fiction.
Oh. Hmm.
And there's another take on it. It's called hope punk. And it's science fiction and fantasy has its own little, you know, enclaves of things. So there's been a longstanding tradition called Grimdark, which kind of speaks for itself.
Yes.
So hope punk is kind of the flip side of the coin from Grimdark. It's, you know, a more optimistic view of the future. It's here are suggestions. Here are things that we can do differently that will make this better.
Trying to step away from the dystopian future. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. That's neat. I'll have to check that out.
Fascinating. We are getting close. Give me the one more question. Boy, so many questions.
Do you have any questions about Queen of Swords?
Well, I'm just amazed that it's someone would just say the natural progression was to start a publishing house. Who does? I've never heard anyone say that before.
Sleep is silly.
In this age, you know, Amazon books, ebooks, and everything else, why does it make sense to start a publishing company and sell paper?
Well, we do ebooks too.
Of course.
And eventually we'll do audiobooks. Working on that.
Oh, that's awesome.
People
still read.
The thing about, you know, publishing books is that you can get to publish voices that might not otherwise be heard or might not be heard the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And And, you know, certainly indie publishing is an option. But what you get when you come to a publisher like me, for example, who's been around for a while, is that I've spent decades building up networks of reviewers and websites and events and all of that stuff. So you get my expertise and you get my ability to go out and market things, which is something I'm decently good at, as it turns out, fortunately.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, and it, for me, from my standpoint, it's the, you know, opportunity to put out books I genuinely enjoy and to get readers to check them out. You know, I love turning readers on to new books.
Yeah.
You know, and at this point, there, you know, there's events we do pretty much every year. And so it will show up, we'll set up a table, and inevitably somebody will come over and go, oh, what's new this year?
Nice.
You know, and that's just, you know, it's terrific just to turn people on to these things, new voices, you know, new stories, all of that good stuff. So that's a big part of why I wanted to do this.
Fantastic, yeah. Fantastic. Queen of Swords Press here in Minneapolis. That's wonderful. We have had a special show. I'm Dave. That is?
Savvy.
Savvy. You are Savvy. And we were with Catherine and Jenny and Michael, writers for Queen of Swords Press. Catherine Lundoff is also the publisher. You have been listening to Write on Radio. And now, thank you all for coming. Why don't you say
thank you.
Yay. And now this. Oh, I...